Thank you for the introduction. It was really good, and I like it much better. I don't know whose time was it, my time or your time, that we lost, but I'll try to be brief. Children are different, people are different, we all know it, and we assume today that it's all genetically determined, although it might be in a few years that we will understand that there are other components involved, and it's not all genetics, but certainly a major part has to do with genetics. Just to go over briefly about the history of the development of modern genetics, in 1865, Mendel made his famous garden experiments on peas and found out the Mendelian rules of dominant and recessive transmission of genes, but he wasn't recognized at that time, like many people who preceded their time, and no one heard about him and no one really took any care of what he said, and only in 1900 his experiments were confirmed by others, but he was lucky enough that his name stayed, and we don't even remember who the others were that confirmed his original testings. And then the development went a little further. The DNA was discovered. The genetic screening process, especially in the United States, on Tay-Sachs screening. And we go now to the genetic engineering and the Human Genome Project and somatic gene therapy. These are partially futuristic things, but not in the far future, and some are already operative. And indeed, genetics is one of the fields that made the most significant advancements in recent years. I want to talk about some facts related to genes, which I think are important both from a scientific point of view, but especially from a philosophic and Ashkafa point of view. There are genes that are determinant, and there are genes that are only causing a predisposition or inclination to certain traits and diseases. There are some that are combined. So, for instance, there are genes which determine specific traits or diseases, and they are 100% determinant. We can do nothing about it. Once the gene is there, that is how the outcome will be. So it can be the color of the eye, and it can be Tay-Sachs disease. Whoever has the gene for either of them, obviously diametrically opposed issues, but still genetically the same. No one can do anything about the fact that if the gene exists, the color of the eye will be blue, or the child will have Tay-Sachs disease. There are some genes that specifically determine a disease, and in 100% the disease will occur, but the presentation of the disease will be varied amongst those who carry this genetic abnormality, although the genetic abnormality is the same. A Down syndrome is composed of 21 of an extra chromosome, but there are different presentations of Down syndrome. There are those who have an IQ of 70 and those who have an IQ of 30. There are those who have a heart disease attached to it or dementia, and some who have no other defects, and we actually don't know why one is presenting himself with the Down syndrome of that fashion or another. There are some epilepsy forms which are genetically determined, but the severity of the disease might be different between the people. And then there is a whole host of predisposing genes which in a certain percentage of people who have the same gene will carry the disease and others will not, for reasons that we don't know. The most discussed one is the BRCA gene, the gene for the breast cancer, especially in Ashkenazi Jewish women. But not all Jewish women or all women who carry the BRCA will eventually have breast cancer. Only about 80% will have it. Some will not have it, although they carry the same gene. So there is a variety of facts related to genes which we have to take into account, especially when we are talking about mass screening. And then there are genes that may be mitigated or changed according to environmental influences. For instance, we assume, although it wasn't found yet, that there is a gene or a couple of genes or many genes that control intelligence. But even if someone has a gene for a very high IQ production, if he will live in the jungles of Africa, he will never become an Einstein, even though he has the gene. And on the other hand, there are those whose genetic makeup is that their intelligence is a little lower than average, but if they'll get a very good specific education, they may rise into a significant function from an intelligence point of view. So there are interacting genes, multifactorial issues, environmental issues. So genes are not the whole story, and we know it for many, many facts. The Jewish people, as yesterday was mentioned, might have a specific gene that makes them a part of the Jewish people, but there is also a high prevalence of genetic diseases amongst certain Jews, and they are different amongst others. Here is a partial list of diseases which are typical or more frequently encountered in Ashkenazi Jewish population. And it's not a small list, and some of them are very significant diseases. There are others who are specific to Persian Jews, and others who are for Moroccan Jews. So that we vary according to our tendencies to what types of diseases we may harbor depending on the fact, A, that we are Jewish, and B, that we are Jewish of a certain origin. That has a significant influence on how we screen populations for genetic diseases. So here we are missing the Hebrew words, but there are only few, so that won't bother the continuation. How do we relate to scientific discoveries altogether? So Dr. Zimmerman mentioned some of the conceptual issues of interfering with nature, with God's wishes and God's creation, but there are general approaches to what do we do with new discoveries. We discovered now that we know what a genomic makeup can cause. How do we use it? So one approach would be that we should be extremely cautious with any new scientific or technological invention, and the quotation was Chadash Asur Min HaTorah, a famous quotation of the Chatam Sofer. Chadash is a new crop of corn or wheat that you can't eat it until a time passes, until Tezayin Benisan, and before it, it's Asur Min HaTorah. But Chadash may mean anything new. Anything new is forbidden. Once you brought me something new, first of all, it's also. Then we can discuss it further. But in fact, the Tiferet Israel has a very nice statement, and I think that might represent a very different approach. The Tiferet Israel on Masechet Yadayim, I think people get to it only if they learn Seder Mishnayos up to the end, but usually you don't learn Masechet Yadayim on a daily basis. So he says there, anything which we have no reason to prohibit is permitted without having to find a reason for its permissibility. For the Torah does not mention every permissible thing, but rather only these things which are forbidden. The Torah tells us there are forbidden issues. Whatever is not forbidden is automatically permissible. I think in our generation, we do the opposite. Whatever is not permissible, we say also. But really, it should be the other way around. If it's not forbidden, it's permissible. So that if we get something new, a new invention, a new scientific discovery, and we ask, Is it permissible halachically or not? We need to find a reason not to permit it. And if we don't find such a reason, we don't need to look for a reason to allow it, because automatically it will be permissible. That is the position of the Tiferet Yisrael. So I will skip some of the issues which were already discussed earlier, so it saves some time. I want just to touch on one concept which is frequently used in the lay literature, which I think is a nonsensical argument. And this is playing God. Whenever we do something new, something big, we transplant organs, we donate eggs, we use genetic material for cloning, and so on. So the argument, the initial argument is, you're playing God. It's not your job, you're a human being, you can't do it. That is certainly not a Jewish approach, because anything, including the genetic revolution, is only technical. It's not fundamental. The genetic revolution, as other new things that come up in the world, are only revealing existing things and not creating something new. The concept of God power, is to do something from nothing. Yesh me'ayin. No human being ever, and probably forever, will be able to do such a thing. No one can create something from nothing. All that we do, all the inventions that we do, are using something and changing it to something different. Something from something is not similar even to what God can do. And therefore, in fact, what we are trying to do with all the inventions, provided they are for benefit, we are actually continuing the work of God in a sense that we're taking what God has created and changing it for the benefit of the human being. And in fact, when we, the more we study, the more we look into scientific matters, if we have open eyes and open minds, we have to be stronger in our belief that there is a creator, that there is an almighty that has done it. Because whenever there is a plan, there must be a planner. It can't be that this house stood up on itself. Everyone will tell you it's a nonsense. Someone created it. Someone planned it. Someone built it. It can't come out of nothing. And therefore, the whole world cannot be something that was just done by chance. It doesn't make sense, not statistically, not reasonably, not philosophically. And therefore, the more we understand the complexity of the world, and we now are mature enough as scientists to know that we don't know most of the things that still are in existence. What God created so many years ago, we still are grappling with the beginning of understanding the depths of the creation, and to say that everything is by chance, that we are playing God, and we are as good and as strong and as mighty as what we believe God is to me a nonsense thinking if you are serious with your understanding. So enhanced knowledge of macro and microcosmos actually enhances the belief in the Almighty God. And therefore the concept of playing God is really out of the plane. It is nothing that we should discuss. The more serious aspect is, are we interfering with nature? And I won't repeat what Dr. Zimmerman so nicely presented. I have similar sources, and we understand that actually it is permitted to interfere with nature. In fact, in my understanding, it is not only permitted, but perhaps even obligated. Uredu ba'aretz b'chivshua, you should conquer the world, according to the Ramban's interpretation that we heard earlier, is that you should make use of the world. This is your task, your mandate as an intelligent creation. God gave us the intelligence to use it. And if we don't use it, we really go in contra what God created in the world. There are, however, a few qualifications to this interference. One is that the actual act must not involve any inherent halachic prohibition. For instance, if we create a mule out of a horse and a donkey, we create something which is better than his ancestors. It has more strengths, it can do better work, it is better. So, from the concept of doing better and improving the world, that should be something that we should do. However, inherently, it is prohibited. Kadosh Baruch Hu said that we can't do kilayim, for whatever reason. We don't go into the reasoning, but this is a prohibited act. And therefore, we can't use the betterment argument when the process of doing it is prohibited. But if the process is not prohibited and it is bettering the world, we are actually obligated to try and do it so that things will work better. Also, the act must lead to no unavoidable or irreversible result, which is halachically prohibited. Perhaps when you do the actual act, there is no prohibition involved. But if you know that the outcome will be such that will involve a prohibition, then don't start with it, because you'll get into a situation where it will be prohibited halachically, and that you can't do. And the final one is that the derived benefit should surpass the detriment. That is obvious. We should do whatever we are doing to make the world better and not to make the world worse. That is not the mandate we got to destroy the world. We got the mandate to build it and to do it better. So if we have in mind those three qualifications, we actually should be engaged in new technologies and new inventions to help the human being. And now remember that science and technology per se is morally neutral. The fact that there is a gene and the fact that this gene can do so or so is not an ethical discussion at all. That is a fact of life. Science is a fact. What interests us from an ethical point of view is how do we use the fact? What is the use that we make out of the scientific fact, out of the scientific discovery? And the use is what we are dealing with when we talk about ethics, not the mere fact that there is something there or there is a possibility to do something. So when we talk about genetics, there are several ethical issues that have to be engaged, and for a shortage of time, I will not elaborate on those, but I think it's important to realize it when we're talking about these issues. The first step is to reveal the information. If I discover a genetic disease in someone, the first thing that I have to deal with is, how do I tell it to this person? How do I approach the revealing of the information? Should I tell him at all? So forget about autonomy in the extreme position, which says always you have to tell everything because he has to deal with it and not you, and it's his body, and autonomy tells you to tell everything. So if you discover that he has a Huntington's gene, you have to tell him you have a gene for Huntington. At the age of 30, you'll start to be demented, and at the age of 40, you'll die. And you deal with it. That's your problem. I told you what you have, autonomy. That is certainly, from an ethical point of view, from a Jewish perspective, a wrong way to do. Why should you impose so much harm on him just for the sake of the principle of autonomy? So, how do you reveal the information? When do you reveal the information? Do you reveal the information? To whom do you tell it? All these are real concerns if you take away autonomy as an overriding principle. The informed consent measure is also important. You have to take into account that the person has to deal with it. So he has to know whatever he knows in order to consent to further interventions. Confidentiality becomes a major issue in mass screening and in genetic counseling. Because let's say I find out that the female patient that came to me is a carrier of BRCA. If she is a carrier of BRCA, her sister might be a carrier of BRCA, and her mother may be a carrier of BRCA, and her daughter may be a carrier of BRCA. Do I tell all her next of kin or her female next of kin, that they should be tested because they might have this carrier state. And what if the patient tells me, I don't allow you to tell others because I don't want anyone to know that I am the carrier. If you tell my sister, she knows that I am a carrier, I don't want her to know. But if I'm not telling her sister, maybe I'm doing harm to her sister. So what are the limits and the boundaries of confidentiality in this instance? And there are a whole host of other issues of similar magnitude. Now, when you do mass screening, you may enter into questions of eugenics and of forms of therapies that may not be approved yet, and into the issue of mass screening. And mass screening creates special problems. So how do you screen? There are various stages by which you can screen for a genetic disease. You can do a premarital diagnosis, you can do a pre-implantation diagnosis, and you can do a prenatal diagnosis, and obviously you can diagnose an adult with a disease. So if we talk about a premarital screening, means that what Dor Yesharim is doing in Israel and maybe in the United States, and there are now some other organizations, that they take single boys and girls, screen them for diseases that they don't know whether they are carriers or not. They are healthy people, but they may be carriers of genetic disease. Everyone can be a carrier of Tay-Sachs and he's healthy. Unless he's tested, he doesn't know. So you can, before marriage, screen the whole population, give them, either tell them that they are positive or not, or give them a number and keep the secret whether they are carriers or not. And when a boy and a girl meet, they can call to this center, and the center will tell you are a match or you're not a match, from a genetic point of view. Nothing to do whether they are appropriate to each other or not. But if both of them are carriers of Tay-Sachs, they have 25% chance to have a child who is sick with Tay-Sachs disease. So before they got married, they already know whether it's worthwhile to get married based on the premarital screening. Can we do it? Should we do it? So that was a very interesting history. Moshe Feinstein initially said that you shouldn't do it, and that had to do with the history of the initial screening for genetic diseases of the black Americans that had the sickle cell disease trait, and they were discriminated because they were carriers. Now remember, a carrier is a totally healthy person. Nothing is wrong with him. But if you want to discriminate, you say, well, he carries a disease, so he can't be a pilot, and he can't be in the army, and he can't get this or that job. And there was a significant discrimination. So Moshe said, if the blacks as a minority are discriminated for being carriers of sickle cell disease, the Jews, will, again a minority, will be discriminated because they are carriers of Tay-Sachs disease. So better don't do it. But once this was overcome, and today everyone knows that you can't discriminate for a carrier state, but Moshe really asking that you should be screened, and it was mentioned already that that has nothing to do with Emunah and Bitochon. You have to know something which is very simple and obvious to be tested and has important ramifications, and therefore he allowed to do it. And indeed, Dor Yesharim was created because the founder of Dor Yesharim had three or four children who died of Tay-Sachs disease, and feeling that the terrible burden on a family that doesn't know ahead of time that this can happen to them, he created this organization. The problem with Dor Yesharim is that they are screening for very few diseases, six or seven diseases altogether, and you saw the list of diseases that can be at the Ashkenazi, at the Moroccan, at the Persian, at the Yemenites, and so on. There are hundreds of diseases, so that is not sufficient. They have also an ethical issue. They don't disclose to the one that they tested that he is a carrier or not. He gets a number, and it's a secret. And that was created because in the Haredi community, someone who is a carrier is a little bit different than others, and it may be harming to the shidduchim of the family. So better no one should know, and just when it happens, you tell them a match or not a match. It can be done probably in a different way, but that's their policy. And in Israel, for the last 20 years since Dor Yesharim operates, there was no new Tay Sachs case in the Haredi community. Well, before then, there were a few dozens a year. So that really was a very helpful initiation. So premarital screening is certainly okay. The PGD screening process, which was discussed already earlier, and I won't go again over the technique, but what we can do in PGD is do an IVF procedure and check all the fertilized eggs for the particular gene in that family. Let's say this family had already a child with Tay Sachs, so we know that both parents are carriers. So for the next pregnancy, we'll do this procedure, we'll select the fertilized eggs that don't carry the gene for Tay Sachs, and we will plant them into the womb of the mother, and we can assure the couple that they will have a child who doesn't have Tay Sachs. We can assure the family that it will be a perfect child, which usually that's what they want to hear. But that has nothing to do with PGD. All we can tell them is, he won't have Tay Sachs. And those fertilized eggs that carry the gene, you just discard. You throw it away in the garbage. So that obviously created a halachic question. I presented this question to Abel Yashiv about 8 or 9 years ago when it started to become an issue, and maybe I'll finish with a story about that because time is up. And the story was, I had a friend in New York, a very well-to-do person, and you'll understand in a minute why I add this fact, and he had a daughter that had neurofibromatosis, which is a neurologic and multi-systemic genetic disorder that can cause mental retardation and epilepsy and kidney problems and eye problems. But she was healthy. She just had the gene. She had a few birthmarks that are the hallmark of the disease. And when she got married, she was very worried what will happen with her children. That's a dominant gene, which means that even if the husband is totally clean of this gene, 50% of the children will inherit the disease. So, to make a long story short, the PGD process started then, and I told my friend, I'm willing to go to Abel Yashiv to present him the new technology. No one then dealt with the halachic implications of discarding eggs and doing the procedure when they are actually fertile. They didn't need an IVF procedure. And whatever he'll say, I'll tell you. He said, oh no, you go to him, he'll say also, like he usually does, and then what do I do? Then I'm stuck. So I told him, you know what, I'm going to ask my question. I'm not mentioning you, I'm not talking to you. That's a new shayla, like with all new shaylas that I go to ask, I'll ask him. If he'll say it's okay, I'll tell you. If he will say it's also, I won't tell you. You look for whoever you want, and you didn't hear from me anything. So I went to Abel Yashiv and I presented him this procedure, and after a very brief thinking, he said, muta. And I asked him, and what do you do with the sick eggs? Throw them into the garbage. That was his answer, and whoever knows Abel Yashiv, he doesn't explain himself, he doesn't give reasons, he doesn't discuss it anymore. You ask, you get up, and someone else comes with another question, and the day goes on. So I called my friend, and I told him. Rabbi Yashiv said muta. He was very happy. He went to Chicago, to Berlinsky, who was then the big expert on PGD. And by now, I think his daughter has 3 or 4 healthy children, and he's very happy. And he came back to Israel, and he said, I am so happy for my daughter. I want to help other daughters. So I want to open a unit of PGD in Israel so that Jewish girls will have the benefit. If Rabbi Yashiv allowed it, why not? And the best place to him was Shaare Tzedek. So I took him to the director general of the hospital, and he came and said, I'm willing to put out as much money as needed to create the unit. He said, I don't want it. So what do you mean? I'm bringing you money, and I want you to create a unit. It will be good for the hospital, and you'll get a good name, and you'll have... He said, the initial money is easy to get. The problem is the upkeep. And once I agree to it, I'll have so many expenses that I can't handle it. I'm not such a big hospital that can handle it. So he said, you know what? I'll pay for the upkeep. Not only will I create the unit, I'll keep on paying as long as needed for all the patients, for all the instructions of new people, all their salaries, I'll pay everything. And that's how he did it, and by now we have a unit that had over 100 children born, all healthy to very sick children. The condition of our leadership to allow it was that it should be done only for serious diseases, not to run into the slippery slope of doing it for minor diseases or for traits. If someone wants a child with blonde hair and blue eyes, we can do it by PGD, but that obviously will be forbidden. So we have a committee, myself and the rabbi of the hospital, that we discuss each case, each applicant, what the disease is, why does he want PGD, and we help do it. There are serious new questions coming out of this procedure, and for instance, I mentioned earlier at the presentation of Rabbi Apfel the issue of doing PGD to create a child that would be HLA matching for an existing sibling. That creates serious problems. You create a child not for his own being, but for him helping someone else. Is that permissible? The poskim of Shaare Tzedek allowed to do it, and we did already two cases like this, and it was a big happiness. The children are small, but it seems like, and we followed them, that psychologically they are doing fine, and they are not out of the way on either direction. You can assume that they'll be the best loved children because not only were they created, but they saved a sibling, or they will be put aside. Okay, you did your job, but we really didn't want another child in the house, and both aspects are working so far fine. The other question that we just recently solved was to do PGD for adult onset disease such as BRCA. When you do it for Tay-Sachs, that's easy. If you accept that PGD is halachically allowed and you are saving a child that otherwise will die within a few years and will become seriously sick right away, then it's easy. But what about eliminating a female that is a carrier of BRCA in a PGD process where this, if she would have been born, she could live 30, 40, 50, 60 years normally and well and be happy and do good for the world, and then get breast cancer. Is that good enough a reason not to create a priori, not to run into an adult onset disease? It's a significant problem, and finally, after a lot of discussions with the poskim, we decided that it is allowable, and we did already a few cases like that. Then we have the question of sex selection, which you heard at length, and I won't go into it. There is the question of a slippery slope. What will happen if we find out a gene for aggression? Would we be allowed to eliminate children who have a gene for aggression because we want timid, nice, quiet children in the house, and that is how the parents want it. Will that be something that PGD will be allowed for? And there will probably be more and more issues of this kind. There's also a problem, who do you take it from and at what stage? And I won't go into all these dilemmas, and I just want finally to mention the prenatal genetic screening, which means that the woman is already pregnant and you can screen the fetus for a disease, but that means that if you find the disease, you need to abort if you want to avoid the birth of the child. And that brings us to the whole difficult issue of abortion for fetal reasons, which it is not the time now, and I think I'll stop here. Thank you. Well, they can request. The question is, what do you do with this request? I mean, no, I don't think it's a halachic question in the sense that if a family wants a perfect shidduch and they don't want to compromise on anything and they want to make sure that it's a perfect shidduch, so the other side, if he agrees, fine. If he doesn't agree, no. You can't compel, if that's your question, you can't compel the other side to undergo screening for diseases for shidduch purposes. That's obviously not a halachic requirement. But if by agreement or by social norms that is how things are being done, and perhaps one day that is what will happen, I don't envy the future generations that will live in such a way, because we all have all kinds of genetic carrier diseases that we will never meet anyone to be perfect. But if it will go this direction, then that will be a social norm. I don't think it has to do anything with halacha per se. It is an agreement. You can say, is it halachically required that a shidduch should be without eyeglasses? The answer is no. But if a couple, if a parent says, I want a son-in-law who doesn't have glasses, so he'll opt for someone who doesn't have glasses. There's no compelling halachic requirement of this kind. I don't think it's healthy to do it from a social point of view. I think it's overdone already, and with time, when genetics will be more advanced, it will probably go in this direction, and as I said, I don't envy the future couples. Yes. No, it was personal reasons. The women that came to request to eliminate a female with BRCA in their pregnancy were young women who had already breast cancer, that their mothers died in a very young age, that their sisters are very sick at the moment, and personally and emotionally they just couldn't handle it. And I think that is a valid reason to do it, not because of societal reasons. We don't propagate to do everyone in the Jewish community to look for BRCA and to eliminate females of this kind. I think on the contrary, usually adult onset diseases shouldn't be discarded. But in personal issues like those, and really they came crying and they were very upset for the fear that their daughter will go through what their mother and sister and herself went through, this made to us reason that that is serious enough for this family. Yes? Well, someone has said already. Sorry. What? Okay. Someone has already said, beware not to go in a slippery slope of a slippery slope. Because once you use a slippery slope argument, you do nothing. Whatever you do, there might be a slippery slope. And therefore, when you use slippery slope cautiously, it is a valid argument. When you use it for everything, it becomes a slippery slope by itself. So here, you have a serious disease that will not affect 100% of the carriers, that is true, that can be prevented or treated to many of those patients if they have it, that is true. But the amount of suffering within a particular family that so many individuals in the family suffer, That is a valid argument. So that is why you need a committee, a judge, a rabbi to have the fifth Shulchan Aruch. Nothing goes black and white. There's no black and white. So you have to judge case by case. As I said yesterday, the approach is a casuistry approach. It's not a principle. By principle, you're right. In principle, you shouldn't do adult onset diseases. But on a casuistry basis, if you have a case and you see the suffering entailed in this particular family, I think it is justified. Again?
For clarification, that these two patients have compelling reasons.
Right.
But not
the absolutely. We don't do it automatically to every, and we don't suggest it to every BRCA carrier to do it in their family, only if they come to us. And then we look into the family. Why do they want it? Why do they want this procedure?
And by definition, did you do gender selection also in that case, or did you extract the BRCA?
No, it wasn't. We can't extract it. It's either or. There's no way today to have a female carrier BRCA and correct it and take out the gene.
No.
If a female didn't have the BRCA, the family didn't want a gender selection. They just didn't want a BRCA carrier, which happens to be a female. By the way, there are males who have BRCA gene, and a very small minority has cancer. But that is such a minute proportion that we don't go after.
And they discovered that each one was carrying cystic fibrosis. And they had somebody at the beginning of several postgame. Somebody invited them to a field of the tomorrow, get married and write down if you do this.
Right. That's our advice as well. We have several couples already that went out. I mean, in the Haredi community today, in most, you don't start going out until the parents found out that everything is okay from their perspective. So it's less common. But in the, should we call it modern Orthodox or other types of form, Jewish people who go out and fall in love and decide to get married, and then they go and test. So to separate them after they are being involved, when you have this option, the psak that we follow is that they can go ahead on the tnai that they'll do PGD if that's what they want. In fact, we have a very choshev family. I won't obviously mention a name, someone that everyone in this room I'm sure knows. In this family, there are three males who are very sick with an X-linked mental retardation gene, and the females in this family, there are many children there, the females, some of them are carriers, and they get married lechatchila to do PGD for females and not for males. Otherwise they won't be married at all. Yes. I don't understand the question. Yes. I mean, if the purpose is to look for genes of traits that are blue eyes, again, for that example, then the answer is no. What use will it be? Why should you look for such genes when it doesn't matter at all? But if you look for genes that cause diseases, and after you found them, you can help the family not to have such a child, then absolutely so. I, as a pediatric neurologist, when I have a patient, a child, who has a neurological genetic disease, a significant one, I counsel the parents to go for finding the gene of this child in order for the next pregnancies to do PGD. Well, if you want to skip, if you want to skip your break, I can give you a lengthy talk. As opposed to. So what's your question? Should we do testing for those as well? Well, we did, for instance, a testings of PGD to adult women, let's say 41, 42, where the chances to have a Down syndrome increases. Down syndrome has a whole spectrum, and there are many Down syndromes who are very nice people, who are very happy with themselves. The fact that they look different and I don't want to be a Down syndrome doesn't mean that he's not happy. And his life may be fuller than mine by not coming to this conference and not listening to my talk. It may be even nicer. So the fact that a person is affected doesn't mean necessarily that he is not happy with his life. Yet, the woman over the age of 37, 38, and certainly over 40, is very apprehensive in our days. And her pregnancy will be very affected if she will not know for sure that she doesn't carry a Down syndrome. So in order to give her peace of mind, halachically, the peace of mind of a pregnant woman is a very important factor. And therefore, we're allowed to do it as well. Right. What is important is the option that it will be and the apprehension of the couple, of the parents, to help them. A psychological upset, halachically, is like a physical upset. You're allowed to desecrate Shabbat in order for a woman, for a person, not to become mentally, not only physically. So halachically, they are very similar.
Thank you very much, Professor Steinberg. We're running a few minutes behind, so with your indulgence.